peoples of the internet, welcome. I was getting sick of ladies and gentlemen, welcome. So peoples of the internet, welcome. This is episode 63 of On the Time Lash. Hiya, Mark. How's it going?
It's going well, Ben. It's going well. Hello, Ben. I should say hello, Ben, because obviously you don't introduce yourself. You've introduced me. And people might be like, oh, I know who Mark is, but who's the guy that's currently talking? I say guy. Obviously, you're very woke millennial address to the peoples of the internet. Who is the person that is speaking to me right now?
I don't know. It's we are nearly at the beginning of a new series of Doctor Who, and forget it. I don't even want to go into that territory. let's start that again. So we've said hello, Ben. So we're all right. Mark, this is our Night Terrors and Survival episode. I'm looking forward to this. Survival is one of my very favourites.
Two stories that I actually quite like. That's right. I like Night Terrors. We'll come to that in more detail later on.
Positivity and Doctor Who fandom. This cannot be real. Before we kick off, how's your fortnight since the last episode? Fortnight and Doctor Who been, mate?
Yeah, I mean, it's all just kind of, I guess, excitement starting to build around the new series. You're getting the usual sort of press stuff, so like the interviews. I mean, Marie Claire, as we discussed in the last episode. All sorts of stuff. But the new Doctor Who magazine is out as we record this. Well, not as we record this. It's out to me because I'm a beloved subscriber of Doctor Who magazine.
So which one did you get?
The bog standard version. Subscriber exclusive is that I don't know what the fuck's in it because they've taken the text off the front of the cover.
Yeah. So if you subscribe, you get a textless cover. But there is also with this edition, there's the normal edition with the text on, but now there's also a WH Smith exclusive, which is like a tenner, and it's got posters and art cards and stuff. So even as a subscriber to Doctor Who magazine, you don't get this new WH Smith exclusive, but you get it quite in advance of me, who is a just bog standard going to Forbidden Planet purchaser. Subscribers get it so far in advance that before you even get your hands on it. The actual off the newsstands, you know everything. Yeah. Like I know all the preview information now for the first two episodes of the new series starting,
which is not much. It's basically, I think, much like every series before it, certainly of the new stuff. Contemporary Earth opener, space second episodes. That's basically all the information that we have.
But rather nicely, I don't know. It's not a London set story. Sheffield is where episode one is taking part,
and they filmed in Sheffield as well, didn't they? So it's not like Cardiff pretending to be Sheffield, either. So that's quite good.
what a come down for Cardiff. Apologies to our peoples of the internet who are listeners in Sheffield.
Indeed, I've never been to Sheffield, so I could not possibly comment on its civic quality.
I think I know it from the stripping unemployed people. What was that film called? The Full Monty. There we are. The stripping unemployed people.
That's a Channel 5 documentary right there, isn't it? Well, the other thing actually I just wanted to mention before we go into the main body of the episode. So the season 19 Blu-ray box set, Peter Davison's first series, is out, what, November the 19th?
I don't know, because I don't care.
I'm buying it, but purely because I currently work for a well-known entertainment retailer and I can get 30% discount on it, so
okay.
I can justify that to myself. However, what I don't know if I can justify myself is that at the BFI, 2 days beforehand, there is a cinema screening of Earthshock, with a Q&A with Eric Sayward and Matthew Waterhouse.
Your favourites, so.
Yeah, my favourite, you know, my favourite Doctor Who writer of all time, Eric Sayward. So tickets go on sale to the public on Tuesday at 11 o'clock. However, if you are a BFI member, the tickets are on sale just now. A friend of mine is a BFI member, and last night I just texted him. I said, could you buy me a ticket? And I was like, the minute I sent the message, I was like, what are you, you hate Earthshock. You hate Eric Sayward. Why are you spending £12 on a ticket to watch that, and then the £30 train fare there and back to watch Earthshock in a cinema.
It's a nice event. Because if it was just somebody wheeling out a television, like, you know, in school when it was like a rainy day in PE, that don't do that.
Yeah.
But like the BFI, so we went to see The Power of the Daleks at the BFI. And that was a great event. Yeah. You know, like that was a nice Doctor Who event. And this is where like these things are most real. Mm. That's where fandom is most real, is when you get to appreciate it in a great surrounding, watching it in a way, in like the best way it could ever be presented.
Exactly.
You know, maybe you'll change your mind.
Well, the thing is, I used to like it. Now I don't like it. So who knows what will happen after I've seen it on the big screen, you know, in the lovely, you know, NFT1, the BFI. So yeah. But so I just thought I'd flag that. So if anybody is going, if anybody's already got the tickets, or if anybody gets tickets on Tuesday, say hello. I'll be there. I'm in row D, seat 19, apparently, so come and say hello.
Okay. What have you decided, just so people can identify
you? Oh, sure, yeah.
What red bubble t-shirt will you be wearing?
I don't have any Davison era ones. Maybe I should buy a Davison era one specifically for the purpose of going along. We shall see. But yeah, I'll put it up on Twitter.
You'll be wearing a Doctor Who themed t-shirt and suit jacket combo to look out for. Actually, that is literally every male Doctor Who fan who has some association with podcasting or blogging. That is the
yes,
uniform.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
So you'll have a tough time identifying Mark. Stats. Night Terrors was written by Mark Gatiss, and this is his fourth of 9 episodes contributed to Doctor Who up to this point. And it was directed by Richard Clarke. It's also his fourth story, his fourth of 4. He's previously directed things like Lazarus Experiment and The Doctor's Wife. It was broadcast on the 3rd of September 2011, and it was seen by just over 7.07 million people. Those are the cheeky stats. Where, though, because we've come to it, this is always my favourite bit. Degsy's Where Did It Come game!
Fantastic. Our good friend Derek Anderson, creator of this lovely game, has guessed 203 for Night Terrors. It's not a beloved story by any stretch of the imagination, I don't think. So, I probably similar kind of... I'll go, just to be different, I'll go 210.
210. Okay. Yes, you are both... You're both in the final column, as is Night Terrors itself. Night Terrors is actually 189.
Oh, right, okay.
And it is between 188, The Invasion of Time, and 190, Nightmare of Eden. So, yeah, Night Terrors. More like Shite Terrors is the popular fan opinion. But I think Mark wants to change that, so I'll let you open up.
Paul McAvoy on our Facebook page, usually someone who's been very positive about the Moffat era so far. Certainly this series of the podcast, he's defended episodes such as Curse of the Black Spot, sort of finding little positive things in there to enjoy. So he writes, "This would usually be where I say that the episode doesn't deserve the hate that it has, and that it has certain qualities. But Night Terrors is shite." So no love from Paul McAvoy for Night Terrors. However, our dear friend J.R. Southall, friend of the show, host of the Blue Box podcast, I think Night Terrors is very underrated. I didn't like it much on broadcast, but a recent rewatch was an entirely different experience. It's very creepy, and the ending makes total sense, especially if you're a parent yourself, maybe. I found I really liked it. And I think I'm with JR on this one, in the divided fan opinion, because I don't remember enjoying it that much when it went out. I remember kind of thinking it felt like a kind of gritty reboot of Fear Her, because it was a bit darker, it was a bit scarier, but ultimately it's dealing with very similar themes. And almost entirely similar alien threat, an alien life form inhabiting the body of a child. In this case, it's sort of pretending to be a child, and, you know, and obviously fear her, it has sort of possessed the child, as it were.
Yeah, and then struggling with its own develop and immaturity.
Yeah, so then it becomes this kind of metaphor for growing up, etc., etc., etc. So, I'm watching it this time for this. I actually found it a lot better than I remember it. I think, I think, yeah, it definitely has its problems. And I think the reason we paired this up with Survival is because, obviously, Survival is kind of seen as the kind of precursor to Rose in terms of its sort of real world setting. And sort of Night Terrors is what? So 2011, yeah? So 6 years on from Rose. And it feels, you know, this kind of real world setting is very alien, and and it's not what Doctor Who is anymore. And I think that's why, for me, it's such an interesting episode, because it does have this, there is a creepiness, I think, you know, and there is those, I think those dolls are creepy, and I think, you know, it's, they are quite good monsters, and the bit where Amy transforms into one of them is quite horrifying. Now, I think, obviously, the idea that they're all running around a doll's house is quite goofy, and I suppose isn't ultimately explained that well. Yes, sure, it's a this sort of psychic, this being that is sort of has this sort of great psychic power.
Yeah.
So then Kinoff obviously sort of removes anything that scares it into this kind of other dimension. That's, I can kind of go with that, but then when it's like, oh no, it's not another dimension, it just kind of shrinks them and locks them inside this dollhouse.
I guess that's one of the least convincing aspects of the production for me, is that they don't have a doll's house. They've just got like a normal stately home, but with like weird doll's house elements in it. So to the extent that they've obviously, I think the production looked at it and thought this was a problem as well, because the stuff in the council estate is very atmospherically lit and coloured and shot, but it just seems like it's just a blanket darkness, which is concealing the fact it's just like a Tudor house kitchen,
yeah,
or it's just a stairwell. And then you get these weird things where the peg doll attacks the Doctor and Alex, and he's got like a big pair of comedy toy scissors to kind of poke it back. And I guess maybe if they juxtaposed the creepy real world with an equally creepier constructed doll's house world, we've not seen it, but you know, like you get in certain elements of Celestial Toymaker. Then having like such a real world and an artificial world, and both of them being like quite creepy and quite different.
Yeah,
it would have given. Otherwise, I think this, like, there is a this production is basically a triumph of lighting and direction, but I just think it's slightly let down in the doll's house scenes, because they're quite bog standard haunted house scenes, you know.
And I think it's interesting you say that kind of thing about sort of artificiality, because I find you're absolutely right. I think the scenes where Amy, Rory and the Doctor are kind of going door to door and kind of working their way kind of around this kind of tenement block, there's some really beautiful shots of like the Doctor kind of looking across the kind of balcony onto like the other side of the flats and through the window and kind of seeing George and stuff like that. It's really beautifully done.
Yeah,
I do feel that once he actually gets inside George's flat, and actually all the stuff in sort of the flat interiors do feel a bit artificial. They don't feel like lived in homes.
No, and it's you can't ever see out of windows.
Yeah.
There's like an odd quality of Paradise Towers to it, which is you can kind of stretch your imagination to believe what life would be like. But you almost don't believe that there is anything beyond the window that people can look outside of and understand that there's a real... It's like a weird little island all to itself. But then I guess that's what the story is. We've got George and he is a little weird little island all to himself. So, you know, the production is mirroring his fearfulness and experience, I suppose. But yeah, you're right. There is a weird artificiality to it. And a weird 1970s artifact. Yeah. Like, everybody's house looks like it has never been touched since, like, 1977.
Yeah.
Like, the landlord Purcell's carpet and couches look like he's inherited everything. Like, he's inherited that flat off his nan or something.
Yeah,
you know?
And never redecorated.
Yeah. There's because the wallpaper in places, some of the clocks on people's walls, it is all, like, what do you call it, like, chintz?
Yeah.
That's chintzy kind of weird stuff. Like it's the flat from Abigail's Party.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
well,
that kind
and also the kind of the toys. I mean, apart from like maybe the sort of the robots and stuff like that, the Doctor sets off with the Sonic. But like, there's like a kind of creepy pig puppet.
Yeah, a marionette pig puppet thing. Yeah.
Which, let's be honest, if we're putting scary toys in the cupboard, what the fuck is that still doing out? That's terrifying.
Like, yeah.
Utterly terrifying.
Yeah. Actually, when the Doctor sets off the toys with a sonic screwdriver, I don't know why, but there's like a quote from Family Guy that popped into my head, where it was in Stewie's voice, and Stewie's like over at a friend's house and doesn't like what the other kid's got, and he just turns to him and goes, "You have really bad toys." I remember looking at it just going, who's playing with any of this stuff? And the weird thing is, you are right. Like, what family dynamic is getting Transformer toys, but then also, like, that weird pig puppet thing? You know? And, I don't want to come across as unwoke here, but, I mean, like, because I've made the joke in writing it down that, you know, I guess it is quite progressive for a mum and dad to get a boy child a doll's house. But all of that seems like it's just a lot of shitty old Victorian toys that they've just been given or have found. You know, like, there's a lot of stuff like that. Like, it's like, no wonder the kid is scared. Like, the cupboard that he has in his room is chilling as fuck. Like, it's, you know, it's, yeah, it's, you are right about the artificiality, because there's a lot of stuff where, when you look at it, you go, how has that ended up in people's house? Where are you getting this stuff from? What is happening?
And I wonder if that's a case of the fact that, you know, and I'm a big fan of Mark Gatiss as a writer, but I think where his strengths lie, it's always kind of an atmosphere and not so much character, but caricature. That's what kind of lets this down. Because I think, like you said earlier, like, it's kind of this kind of real world reality, which obviously George doesn't feel comfortable in and is terrified, so then takes the elements of that he doesn't like and puts them in this sort of, well, literal cupboard. I was going to say metaphorical cupboard, but no, they are literally in the cupboard. And that would be fine if the flats felt like content, because the thing is, it would be fine if you set that in the 1970s or something. I mean, again, it would maybe be a bit odd, the kind of weird collection of toys that he has. But at least the interior design would at least make sense. But it's just, it feels very much like, it's just like, everything's kind of, like you say, everything's kind of in the 70s, and yet they've kind of got, they're looking through photos of the parents together, you know, is it on a smartphone or a laptop? I can't remember.
There's a good point, because it isn't. It's neither of those things. It's not technology. It's a photo album.
Oh, right. So it is, like, okay.
So they're still using photo albums, like your auntie at Christmas after a couple of sherries gets off the shelf. I didn't notice that until you said it. Yeah, I would have thought that, like, the place to do it would be like have you know, one of those USB sticks, you stick it in the telly, or
so it's odd. So it's like, well, when is this taking place? There's no sense of time or place, which I think is where it kind of struggles, because you then kind of, and I think the kid playing George plays it so alien and so disconnected that you never fully believe that he's a child. He's like a human child.
Yeah. And I guess the way he's dressed as well, he's in like kind of classic kid from the Snowman pajamas. In the sort that I have never seen in any shop, any place. not that a big portion of my month is devoted to buying pajamas
for children.
Or for anyone. But yeah, like, he is, like, he looks like the wee boy that used to be on the old Colgate adverts, who would be cleaning his teeth and stuff like that. He looks like the boy going to his bed.
Yeah.
Like, it's...
So I think that's really what lets it down, is that, like I say, all the exterior stuff is great and it's beautifully lit. And it does feel like a kind of threatening sort of housing estate, and you can see why a kid growing up in that would maybe feel a bit unnerved at night, you know, like the sound of the elderly neighbor coming up the stairs and wheezing as she kind of walks past the window and all that kind of stuff. You can totally relate to that. Part of me was thinking while I was watching, well, is it trying to kind of get across George's perspective? And actually, that's kind of how we're seeing, we as the viewer are seeing the world. Is that kind of what they're trying to achieve? But then it's Doctor Who, and then surely you should be doing it from kind of Amy and Rory's perspective or the Doctor's perspective or...
Yeah, okay. When you're saying about George's perspective, that is interesting because there are no monsters in this. Like, there's a constant chat about the monsters in the cupboard. But there are none. It's like George creates all the monsters. Like, everything that he's scared of is a real-world thing. And it's just his imagination that's running away with him. And then from that, he creates the monsters, as opposed to, like, it's a legitimate thing that's feeding on him. So, yeah, I see it from that kind of perspective. And, I guess that was, like, going into that, that's another thing that I noticed as well, which is it starts in a really odd way for a Doctor Who episode, which is we're told there's a threat, but we never see it. Like, until Amy and Rory get in the lift and disappear... there is no suggestion that there is a threat, other than the fact that, like, this child is powerful enough to project across solar systems and time to be able to contact the Doctor. You know, like that, like him contacting the Doctor and being able to do that. That is the pre-title sequence. I was going to say as well, I wonder if this was originally conceived or written to not be in the present.
Okay, yeah.
Considering that the baddies and the main place where the fear is a doll's house and Peg dolls. I wonder if this is... because up to this point, and, you know, a lot of the stories to come, Gatiss likes the past, particularly the Victorian past. And I wonder if, rather than a housing estate, it was supposed to be like, I don't know, a kind of lonely Downton Abbey type of manor home, something like that. You know, and then that would explain... the complete absence of technology that seems to exist, the weird Victoriana that does show up, as we've talked about, you know, why has this kid got a doll's house? And also the fact that it seems like such a lonely sort of a world, you know. There's like the stock Victorian characters of the angry old woman, the evil landlord who's got a dog on a chain, but he might as well just have a twirly moustache or something, you know.
Yeah, that is interesting.
You know, maybe it was set in the past, but because there's a lot of bouncing around, time travel bouncing around, they wanted to update it. I haven't found any evidence at all to suggest that's the case, but I just find it interesting. Because I do know with this, so this was originally made to be episode 4.
No, was it not episode 3? Because was this not supposed to be instead of Curse of the Black Spot?
Yeah, well, so it was block 1 at any rate. So it was certainly block 1. To the point in doing my reading, Karen Gillan said she was, not that there's much difference, but she was playing at believing that her character was Ganger Amy, as opposed to Amy, which is why there's a weird mention of In the Flesh. When the Doctor and Amy and Rory are reunited at the end of this episode, he says, after she's obviously been a Peg doll, he says something with the emphasis on, it's nice we're all back together, in the flesh.
Right.
And it was an idea that at that point he'd sussed what this was. So I just wonder if there are other elements that have had to be kind of like popped in and scrubbed out at short notice.
I presume they would, you know, they would have probably had a Kavarian sequence in there at some point as well, and
yes, there was, and it was removed apparently. Yeah,
yeah, because I think, because was it not the idea that obviously this, if I remember rightly, this following Day of the Moon, there would have just been a lot of kind of going around creepy houses with torches, which makes sense, I guess, because it does have that kind of X-Files vibe to it as well.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
you know, the Doctor kind of turning up in this house, and there's something not quite right with the kids.
I'm aware that we're kind of drifting towards feeling negative about it, because you said you liked it.
I do like it.
So should we focus on that? I mean, so yeah. So I don't think we think this is the best of the best, but
no,
I think I am with you. Like, I do. Like, I think this is one of the most evocative, I don't want to say beautiful, but certainly evocatively directed and lit Doctor Who episodes. Mm-hmm. The like just the unearthly, ethereal, weird glow of the building at night time, the, you know, the streetlights, the electricity, I just think it looks great. Like it really looks great. I also think it's got some absolutely belting lines in it. Like it is so funny. Like it is incredibly funny. But such small little throwaway lines. Like you really have to. There's a couple of watches before you get them all.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Matt Smith is on absolutely top form. I love his scenes with Daniel. And I think Daniel Mays is great. I love the way he kind of plays that character. It's like this kind of frustration with his son, but there's also that kind of tenderness because, you know, it's his son and he just wants him to be okay. But like he doesn't know how to fix that. And I think he plays that really well. And then the kind of just like utter bewilderment at meeting the doctor as well. Like I think Mays and Smith are just a really good pairing throughout the episode.
Yeah, I guess jumping ahead, my favourite scene is when they're drinking a cup of tea and trying to work out if they should open the cupboard or not.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's a real nice music hall double act feel to that. I really like that scene.
I think it does kind of show Matt Smith's kind of, what shall I call it, kind of like manic strength and kind of in like rattling off this kind of dialogue and, like you say, music hall comedy style routines where it's just like, no, we can't open the cupboard, that's a terrible idea, but then, you know, and sort of doing that whole, I think one of my favourite scenes as well. And the pantophobia ramble as well. His doctor is very much somebody who has this sort of amazing brain.
Yeah.
But perhaps unlike previous doctors, he's kind of lost the ability to kind of not voice every single thought that runs through his head. I think is quite a nice touch.
I love the line that follows that, where he says he's even scared of clowns, and he says, "Understandable." Like that was a great thing. And there's later on a bit where he says something like, "You know, when you're a child, you don't remember." Where you don't remember a lot of stuff. Like it's trying to remember like the name of somebody that you encountered at a party when you were two.
Yeah.
You can't just keep opting for the name Brian and hoping for the best. That's not what it is, but that was a great line. I like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think people's problem with Mark Gatiss is that he has a particular occupation of what Doctor Who is for him.
Mm-hmm.
They are small emotional stories. They're usually done very economically, by which I mean it's never like an entire, like a story spread across galaxies and planets and times.
Yeah.
It's about the Doctor coming into a situation, kind of like, you know, that mid-period Tom Baker, the Doctor comes into a situation, or you perceive a larger situation through very small-scale interactions with the characters and elements of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are disappointed in that because when you see Mark Gatiss, you know it's not going to be a shattering finale quality episode. We've made no secret of saying I like that element. I like that more conservative element of Doctor Who. That's why he's resolutely a middle of the season type of guy.
Definitely.
But it's also where you can enjoy Doctor Who. And I don't know, maybe people are angry they're not immediately prompted to go to the internet and say the word squee in Twitter or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And maybe because it's, you know, it's one of those stories that doesn't require like a 10,000 words. Oh, here's 10 things.
Yeah.
That lead to the season finale. It's nothing. It's a Doctor Who story, and that's fine. It's a self-contained Doctor Who story. And it's a really lovely bit, like I say, the door-to-door scenes where, like, you know, the Doctor and his companions are just, like, knocking on people's doors and trying to find out what's going on. That's great. You don't see that very often in modern Doctor Who.
And it's funny. So one of the threads I did want to pull at is, I find it quite odd towards the end, and I think maybe that's why people do pick up on it, because there are... So I can't really say I feel like it's particularly Gatiss's work, where you see things that kind of draw you out of enjoying the fiction because you've got questions to ask about the logic.
Sure.
But certainly within this one, I encountered one of them, which is why was the mum character, the Claire, not involved in the kind of reassuring of George at the end of the episode? Because you've got the Doctor and Alex and George in the kitchen having a laugh at the end of the episode, and then the mum comes in and then everything seems to be fine, and presumably the kids' fear comes not just from his dad pulling back and being reticent, but also I would imagine he would get that from his other parent as well.
Yeah.
So why is it that it's specifically about the dad being the reassuring figure and not the mum? You know, why wasn't the mum pulled in at the last moment? It's about like a kind of family unit. Now it could just be specifically about it being kind of like the fragile emotional quality of fathers and relating to their sons, or, you know, issues of masculinity. But it hasn't really been signposted enough, I think, and I watched it a good couple of times before this, for you to specifically go, I get it. It's not a family thing. It's specifically like a broken relationship between the father and the child. You know.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. I mean, there is hints at it at the start. Obviously, she's much more pragmatic about it. She's like, you know, we should maybe just get him to see a doctor. We should, you know, because she's a nurse, isn't she?
Yes, so
presumably she's had experience with similar kids and stuff like that. So she's kind of more going down the line of, well, maybe he's got psychological issues that we need to address.
Mm-hmm.
But that is really it. That's the only kind of hint you get that she's more comfortable with the situation than... By that same token, that scene is also cuts back to George in his room, thinking that they're both going to send him away to, like, some mental institution and get rid of him.
So, if he's overheard a conversation, then it's been a conversation that is two ways. He's presumably heard his mum either being complicit in the conversation. I don't know. It just seemed a little odd, because you would imagine if the recollection that because she can't have kids at like a deep emotional point comes so readily back to Alex, it surely should come back to her as well.
But then is that...
And the revelation...
Is that not only because the doctor's kind of, you know, kind of prodding Alex to kind of remember this?
Well, certainly. But if at New Year, as some of the pictures were taken, she isn't pregnant, and then a month later, she has a baby show up, surely friends and family would be sick, like constantly going, but you weren't pregnant. What is this? What is going on? You weren't pregnant. Holy shit, what's going on here? You know...
Mm.
Like it's something again, making me think, like, is it something that was originally set in a, I don't know, the Victorian era, in a big house, far, far out into the countryside, where people's lives are for months on end, you go without like seeing other people.
Yeah.
You know, I just wonder if that.
I think that's a really interesting reading of it, because that is the only place. It would work in a way that I remember seeing Joss Whedon's version of Much Ado About Nothing, which is kind of set in a contemporary society. And it's like, well, you could never get away with like pretending to be dead, you know, in a world with smartphones and social media and all that kind of thing.
Just
hiding in your room for a couple of days. That works in the kind of Shakespearean setting of, like you say, you know, kind of you're living in kind of a big manor house or like with grounds and all that kind of thing. And you don't necessarily go out into the outside world very often. So yeah, you are right. For this story to take place in a contemporary Earth, George's telepathic powers must be absolutely huge. I mean, yeah, obviously he can communicate with the TARDIS. So then, presumably, every time somebody comes into the house to visit Alex and Claire and meet the new baby, they're instantly like, "Oh yeah, of course you were pregnant for 9 months." But yeah, it doesn't quite compute in a kind of modern setting.
Yeah, it's...
But hey.
But I don't hate it. For all of this, I enjoyed it. Like, it was nice. It was just good, nice Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a particularly, articulate or intelligent statement.
The majority of Doctor Who is stories like Night Terrors. Fine, some of them are better realised and stay with you perhaps a bit longer. But it's not always an epic battle to save reality itself.
So we're coming up to, in the second part of this series, like, I'm really looking forward to it, because there's a lot of what we'll maybe call, well, it's not necessarily bottle shows in the sense it's employed by, you know, like American television, but they're very small contained environment shows coming up, which I'm really looking forward to. Like, I love the God Complex. Obviously, next one we've got The Girl Who Waited, which is, that just takes place in a white environment. I don't know, and I feel like this latter half of the series is all the better for it. when it stops trying to do ridiculous big things and just focuses on these contained little emotional stories.
I mean, I've said it before, like, although I do sometimes question Stephen Moffat's emotional maturity as a writer, I do think he's much more interested in kind of... I think it's more obvious when he kind of decides to focus on character rather than the, you know, like, say, the kind of battle for reality itself. That's always kind of a backdrop.
Yeah.
You know, like, the Pandorica opens... the Big Bang is just... four people in a room in a walking around a museum, essentially.
Yeah.
The Wedding of River Song, which we'll come to, is, you know, yeah, it's alternate realities, yes, it's all this, but actually what it boils down to is two couples that love each other. So yeah, so it's interesting. It is interesting, and it'll be interesting to kind of go through the next few episodes, because you're right, actually, I never thought about that before, but it is very small scale, the Doctor and his companions, or the Doctor and Craig.
Yeah.
Or the Doctor's companions and a couple of other people that get bundled in with them.
Yeah.
A shopping centre, well, not a shopping centre, like a department store, a white room,
yeah,
and a hotel.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, they're all, and I don't know if it was a, you know, obviously last episode we talked about why there was a gap over the summer. Was it something that was deliberately part of the planning, or was it something, you know, budgetary, production? But you can't help wondering that this later half of the, as great as it looks, the later half of the series, it is all very, you know, a couple of sets. They look great. They're like, the second half of the series, I really think is an incredible design achievement. Mm. But they are all small, contained stories, you know. But all the better for them. I think this one gets a bit of a hard time because, as I've said a couple of episodes ago, we're beginning to see repetition in the series now. This is maybe the biggest identifier of this, is that we feel like we've been given a Doctor Who where we're not seeing anything new, a story, but also there are elements of things as well. Like when you look at what's his name, Purcell, the landlord, and you see him with his dog on a chain, you can't not think of the guy with the dog on his chain from the 11th hour. So it's not just story ideas and character ideas. It is also, there are also visual elements that look like something else, that prompt you to think of something else as well, I feel. Although, can we just have some love for the Peg dolls? Because the Peg dolls...
Yeah, they're good, man.
Peg
really
dolls
creepy.
Are creepy AF. And I know you said when Amy changes into one, When the first thing you see, when Purcell, the landlord, changes into one, like, he's already a kind of a weird-looking guy to begin with, but when he starts turning into the Peg doll, it's genuinely chilling. Like, it is really chilling. I think the Peg dolls should come back. Well, okay, so what is your favourite... So I've said my favourite scene. What is your favourite scene?
I think it's the same one, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it is Open the Cupboard. I think it's really... Because Daniel Mays... On the flip side, that gets to go through the kind of all the emotions of just like that I've kind of described earlier. I think that is my favourite scene as well. There we go, a tie for favourite scene.
What's your favourite performance?
Obviously Matt Smith gets a lot of good stuff to do, but I'd say Daniel Mays is the guest actor, because the other characters, like I was kind of intimating, and like you kind of, I think, put it better, is that they're all the other characters in it kind of stock characters, and they don't really get much depth.
Mm-hmm.
Like Purcell's just that kind of evil landlord, there's not really much else to him.
But you know when he disappears through the floor, he says, "Help me, Bernard," and obviously the dog's name, he's meaning his dog. And I was like, that's ridiculous. Like, what are you just calling out to your dog? But then I was like, no, there's actually quite a sad intensity to that.
Yeah, because
in that,
that's
literally
all he has.
The only... Yeah, all he has is that dog. Like, all he has is that dog.
Yeah.
And to some degree, by saying, "Help me, Bernard," he's, like, invested that dog with a lot more personality and emotion and care for him than the dog is actually capable of or gives him. And I was like, all right, for the first time, you get that intense sadness which is behind the bullying quality, you know. I was gonna jump on that. I was like, what a stupid line. I was like, no, actually, that's really economical, really decent writing there. So
well,
that was Night Terrors. That was
Night Terrors, Mark. What were you drinking during that, Ben?
So we're recording this in the afternoon, and I've got a gig tomorrow. I'm doing a show, and I've got a rule that I don't drink the day before I'd go and do a show. So I'm not. Yeah. I don't have an alcoholic beverage with. I got a cup of coffee, but I don't have a beverage with me.
Sure.
What, Mark, we know what you're. Mark, what are you drinking? That's what you want to know.
I've been trying to lose a bit of the old beer belly, so I'm kind of not drinking anything at the moment. I've kind of put all the booze in the cupboards. You know, sealed the cupboards. You know, it's all in there. I'm not going to touch it until the end of the month. But maybe I should open the cupboards. Maybe for survival, I should open the cupboards. No, I shouldn't open the cupboard. I should really stick to my, plan to kind of just get a bit slimmer. But I mean, the winter's coming up, so you know, like, the extra weight might help. You know, just keep me warm and might save money on the heating. So maybe I should open the cupboards. Will I open the cupboards? Find out after this.
All right, we're back, and we paired Night Terrors with the final story from Doctor Who's first 26-year run.
I know.
It's survival. What are you drinking with survival?
Well,
Mark?
So I went into Broadstairs Town this morning to get a haircut, do a bit of, you know, just general life admin because it's my day off. And I nipped into a lovely offline, the lovely sort of beer and wine shop down there called The Bottleneck. I'm going to give them a little shout out for reasons that will come apparent in a minute. Because I'd been there before and I got like a really nice bottle of beer called Black Cat. And I was like, oh, perfect. Perfect for survival, right? So I went in, but I couldn't find it. So I said, oh, excuse me, do you still sell the Black Cat beer? And she goes, oh, no, sorry, no, it's a Sussex brewery, so we don't get a lot of Sussex beers in. It's mostly kind of Kentish beers. I was like, oh, okay. I said, is there something else you're looking for? And I was just like, oh. I said, it's quite complicated. There's a friend and I do a Doctor Who podcast. And she goes, oh, I love Doctor Who. She goes, I watched the very first episode, but then I am an old woman. And I was just like, oh, well, I said, you know what, 1963? She goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. She goes, oh, yeah, I love Doctor Who. She said, yeah, but sorry, we don't have any more. I don't know what else to suggest you. I said, okay, I'll think about it. So I took a look at the fridge, and then I opted for In Tribute, because obviously this story is very much about Ace's background, Ace mm-hmm. being kind of the sort of precursor to Rose and sort of other similar characters. And I've gone for a bottle of Working Class Hero from the Cattle Shed Brew Company.
This was an infinitely nicer story about letting someone in on the time lash process. Then we went to the pub a couple of episodes back again, and I said to yeah. I said to the woman behind the bar, we tried to explain what we were doing, and she just looked at us like we'd come in the shit on the floor and danced around it for a bit and then left. Like, it's
my favorite bit about that interaction was when she went, oh, I'm sorry, you need to repeat yourself. I understood the word podcast.
Anyway, okay, but this is survival. So survival, written by Rona Munro. This is her first of two contributions to Doctor Who. The only person to write for old and new versions
yes,
of the,
yeah.
the programme. This is Alan Waring. I think this is his second, third time. I didn't note that down. That is shoddy. But he is the director. and it was broadcast in three episodes between the 22nd of November and the 6th of December 1989. And it had a viewership of basically 5 million. Part 1 was 5 okay. million, part 2 was 4.8 million, part 3 was 5 million viewers.
So it had a consistent audience.
Yes, yeah. It's kind of weird that... So back then... 5 million, which is on the par for what the programme gets now.
Yeah.
And that puts it usually into the top 20, the top 10 uh-huh. for the most part, nowadays of programmes viewed in the country. Back then it was like in the 90s, like 5 million put part one of Survival as the 89th most watched programme.
Wow.
96th, 4.8 million viewing part two, so... And that led
it's
to
crazy,
its cancellation. Led to its cancellation. So, but, you know, again, everybody's favourite first five decades poll, or as we like to call it, Degsy's Where Did It Come game! Where do you think survival is in index is where they're coming.
So Derek has gone for 188. I am going to go higher because I love survival. It's so I'm going to put my cards on the table here. I love this story. I'm a big fan of Rhona Munro. Latterly, I mean, I'm one of these cretins that went to see Rhona Munro plays because I was like, oh, she used to write for Doctor Who. Now, obviously, I go and see her play because it's written by Rhona Munro. Although this, the next Rhona Munro play I'm going to go and see is the Rebus one, so that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Ah, right, okay.
This was the first Doctor Who VHS I ever bought, so I have very fond memories of this story. And I think it's, I think in the years since its broadcast, I think it's got a bit of a reappraisal of the McCoy era, so I'm going to go higher than 188. I'm going to go for 63.
Okay, so Derek, you couldn't be more wrong, Derek. You couldn't be. 188. So 188, we've already been there because it was the Invasion of Time. That is one above what Night Terrors was. Yeah. You are far nearer the mark.
All right.
Mark. that so survival is number 79.
Okay.
It is. Is this ironic? Is this fitting? I don't know. It's between number 78... the very first Doctor Who serial.
Oh, wow.
Which listed here as 100,000 BC, so an unearthly child, that kind of thing. Survival, and then number 80, it's Season Stablemate Ghostlight. Which, again, fitting or ironic, I don't know, whilst Survival was the last story broadcast, the actual last one filmed was Ghostlight.
Yeah. God, that's so weird.
So, right, it's a weird little island that's right there. So there we are.
I was. Listener correspondence before we crack in, before we go into it.
You know, let's do it.
Not much this month, but this fortnight even. JR again. Survival is filled with great ideas, decent music, and some nice location work. But despite some strong performances, there are others that really let it down. In the end, it's a would-be good story where the threat from the humans anywhere ends up feeling silly and inconsequential. I presume he means Mitch. You have to play Mitch more than anything else, but we will see about that. Grant Smith on Twitter, one of our listeners. In my head canon, the woman who complains about the cats at the end is a young Jackie Tyler.
That is brilliant, actually. That is brilliant.
And I always find it a bit upsetting that the woman at the start will never know her son was eaten by cats, that he went to wash the car and never came back. That is quite sad, because actually there's a deleted scene on the DVD which extends that opening just by a couple of more seconds, where she comes back out and she's like, David!
Right.
And then, like, you know, the street's empty. She goes, Dave! And you're like, oh.
Oh, wow,
That poor woman. She's lost her son.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that's what kind of makes Survival such an interesting piece of Doctor Who, is that there is proper real world stakes, and, you know, I think for the first time in a long time, people die in Doctor Who, and it feels, you know, you feel the loss.
I mean, I guess jumping ahead, but yeah, at the end, when they come across Patterson's body, the Doctor and Ace in episode 3, it was really sad inducing. It was really chilling. It was really sad. Because whether you like him or not, like, he was an incredibly layered character. Like, you felt for him in wanting to defend himself. I think you were kind of sympathetic towards him when after Ace gets them all back and he pretends that, like, he's no idea what's just happened and he's been unconscious in the street. Like, you kind of feel for him, like, trying to, like, you know, I've built up a kind of arsenal of strength inside of me, but I'm just not willing to consider that I've actually been on another planet against a threat that I was not ready for, you know, like there's like, and so when he walks in to the self-defense class and the kids part and there's Mitch and the master and you see his face, it is quite harrowed. And then the next thing you see is when the Doctor and Ace burst into the room and he's just there. And it's like a little second-long clip of just seeing his body lying on the floor. And you would think, oh, they're going to wake him up. He's just been knocked unconscious. No, he's dead. That's the end of that character. Yeah.
There's so much. I think it is that grounding. And like we said, you know, like we were talking about with Night Terror, is the fact that the flats all kind of feel like sets. Because I think they were, as far as I'm aware. This, you know, it's the master, like, checking himself out in the mirror in a council flat.
Yeah,
you know?
Which is an actual flat.
An actual flat, you know, they're in an actual block of flats. And I think that's why you feel the loss of those characters so keenly, is because they're recognisable, and because Ronan Monroe as a writer just adds these levels to these characters that, you know, like I said, with some of the supporting cast in Night Terrors, they feel like caricatures. These feel like people, for the most part, that, you know, you could just bump into in your everyday life.
Yes, yeah. There's a weird heightened quality to all the characters. Like, it's a recognisable world, but everyone is angry, aggressive, and quite insular in terms of how they communicate. But it doesn't stop you from, if anything, maybe that makes it even more chilling.
But I think that's kind of one of the themes of the story, though, is anger and the sort of destructive quality of anger. Because obviously that's literally what's destroying the Cheetah People's planet, is this kind of rage.
Yeah, so it's like, it's the same sort of thing where I say, like, George is the one who creates the monsters.
Yeah.
Here, it is another instance of it being the monsters inside. I was thinking about this. Every interaction the Doctor has with anybody is one of anger. I mean, not the Doctor towards them, but every time he encounters somebody, it's somebody being weirdly aggressive or angry with him.
Yeah.
So when he's trying to catch the cat and he's hiding in that old woman's garden, he's being shooed away. When he goes to buy cat food in Halen Pace's shop, they're telling like a weirdly, you know, like just a weird aggressive type of joke. And they're having a back and forth about not wanting to be in their job and what are they doing and life is shit and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
When he shows up, Patterson is like getting on him about his weight and is about health and about looking after yourself. And everybody is aggressive, and it's that aggression that allows the Cheetah People planet's mental hook to get in to you, and you fully become one of these animals when you give yourself over. Like Mitch, when he gives himself over to being a killer, that's when he becomes an agent, and that's why it's so important that Ace chooses not to be a killer, and so she has some sort of redemption, and is able to come back to being Ace.
Yeah.
In a way, the housing estate is used in the same way in Night Terrors, because everybody's aggressive in that as well.
True.
I guess it's funny, but when the Doctor, Amy, and Rory start going around doors at the start of the episode, they're never welcomed. They always have abuse chucked at them, kind of like, what are you looking for? Or is something sinister, like those two weird twins that Amy encounters.
Yeah.
It's all like the old lady is aggressive. It's just like this idea that the housing estate is full of just the worst of, you know, behind closed doors is where we allow to sit the worst of humanity.
Yeah.
There's two bleak kind of readings and outlooks in each of these.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely something in survival about the kind of anger and resentment that kind of builds up when you're part of a community or just general day-to-day human life, and kind of how that can actually oppress you and that will probably actually sort of tear apart this kind of veneer of civilization.
Yeah.
You know, because like you say, Hale and Pace are kind of, you know, they don't want to work on a Sunday, but they've got to because they've got to keep up with the modern
all
supermarkets,
the other shops
and, you know,
that are,
and all the other shops, and that, you know, that's just what people do now. They stay open on a Sunday, so we have to stay open on a Sunday. We've got to make as much money as we can. Which, there's something very 80s about that, but then there's also something very current about that as well, I think. That sort of business competitiveness. And actually, that scene doesn't even need to be in there, really. It's purely there to just facilitate the Doctor getting some cat food. You could have easily have just had him walk in, come out with some tins of cat food. And I think it's one of those rare instances in classic Doctor Who, I think Doctor Who in general, where a scene exists purely for thematic purposes. It's purely to kind of talk about what the story is actually about. And that there's something great about that, actually. And I think something that really lifts it is that it's more than just, you know, the Dr. Scott mystery to solve. There's actually something else kind of going on under the surface. I think, it's terrific.
Yeah. Both of them also have a weird, you could read into this, the bleak outlook of community. Like, even community at close quarters is just an illusion. That there are so many people conducting their life and doing so with a defensiveness and an aggressiveness, which means that community doesn't exist.
Mm.
I don't know if I weirdly find this a bit more readable because to some degree I've experienced it. Because I used to live in Ealing, where a lot of the filming takes place. In fact, you and I have sat in the pub, the Drayton Court Arms. This is the pub that Ace sits outside of waiting for the Doctor to buy some cat food. And I can genuinely attest to that on a Sunday, it's as if it's a ghost town. Like, you don't see people walking the streets, or if you do, it's kind of weird private individuals. The shops are not particularly occupied. It's, you know, you go out to a cafe, cafe's empty. It's just such a weird, eerie time. It just seems like, because I lived there, and it's also it's where they filmed, but also nominally where it is also supposed to be set, Perry Vale and Ealing, that kind of stuff. Yeah, so you do get a sense that you are in the midst of a place with all these amenities, but it doesn't bring anybody any closer together, and a boredom does set in because of that. As much as it looks pretty and nice, I mean, that's I guess where it differs is that, you know, Night Terrors, the housing estate there, is deliberately made to look menacing and awful. Apart from in that last scene where it's suddenly daylight and it just seems...
It's just a housing estate.
Yeah, but in Survival, it's not really a housing estate. It's just like a weird kind of Victorian commuter town that's been absorbed into larger area of London. Like, it looks nice. It looks great. Everyone looks like they're living absolutely comfortably. And it's also a sunny day, so it looks very pleasant to be outside. But it just seems boring. Like, it, you know.
And I think one of the other great elements of it is this idea of... Because I think the resentment for Ace from Mitch is definitely to do with the fact that she's kind of left. And now she's kind of coming back and she's kind of trying to assert herself as the kind of leader of the group. And there's this resentment because, you know, well, you got out. We still live here. We still have to put up with the drudgery and the boredom of this kind of nowhere place, which kind of shuts down on a Sunday. And I think that's great, you know. And also the scene with Ace and what's her name, the charity collector girl,
Ange,
you know, that's a kind of taps into that idea of kind of, you know, you return home after a period away and everybody, like all your friends, have kind of moved on without you, you know, because there's that element to it as well. And these are all things that, like I say, will later kind of come into Doctor Who with Russell T. But to see it in this story, it is really refreshing. Like, it makes Ace feel like a real person. It's, you know, it's about something other than, you know, we've got to save the day. Which, obviously, that is what it's about. It's, you know, it's the Doctor rescuing Shreela and Derek. And the, you know, and Julian Holloway's character, whose name I can't remember.
Patterson,
thank you. You know, saving them from the Planet the Cheetah people, you know, that is what it's about, and sort of stopping them hunting on the Earth. But it's about loads of other things. As all the kind of stories of this last McCoy era, these last McCoy series were, there's much more going on under the surface of just your bog-standard Doctor Who story.
Yeah, like, I like when they arrive back, and I said this already, like, Patterson doesn't want to admit where he's been.
Yeah.
But the delight that Shreela and Derek have at being back in this kind of boring little backwater.
Yeah.
Like, Derek runs off really happy that he's back in this place that presumably up to this point he hadn't really enjoyed particularly, you know. But
yeah, I mean, well, I guess the ultimate kind of, I suppose the ultimate theme of the episode is kind of reevaluating where you're from, you know. And for Derek, it's going, oh, actually, no, yeah, I'm really happy to be back home after this horrendous ordeal. For Ace, it's, well, this place has nothing for me anymore. Like, I'm going back off with the Doctor. And I think that's really interesting as well, in terms of her character and kind of where that character is kind of heading. Well, obviously, we never quite get to see how that plays out.
It's not just about the housing estate setting, which foreshadows the new series. I don't know if it's a full scene that's my favourite, but certainly, like, it's a great line. It's when Ace comes across on the Cheetah Planet, her friends, they seem to have kind of just developed a kind of gallows humour acceptance of the situation. But she, like, hands on hips, says, well, it's a good job that I've arrived to start leading you bunch.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But, that's the first time in Doctor Who... Well, it's probably not the first time in Doctor Who, but it's the first time it's done with that kind of level of... awareness and gusto from the character, that the companion has taken on the mantle of the Doctor, and that there is a leadership quality, a quality to fight for good and defense and survival. So I just love that.
Yeah.
Like, because, you know, like it's like you see in all the new series with like Rose starting to take control of a situation and kind of try and get people to lead their way out of it in the best way they can.
Or Martha, you know, traversing the earth to kind of tell people stories of the Doctor, all that kind of stuff. It starts here.
If we're talking about foreshadowing as well, I do want to pick this up. I've got nothing else than to just read it out, but I just think it's funny. I just think it's funny in the light of this still continued argument about Doctor Who being on a Sunday night now. The very first line as Ace and the Doctor get out of the TARDIS is Ace complaining, "You had to pick a Sunday, didn't you? You picked the one day of the week you can't even get a decent television programme." I just think that's so funny when the programme itself is even weighing in on the debate and declaring Sundays as these a wasteland is, I think, it's hilarious. Yeah, but it's just so funny because there are so many things in this that you can see as the absolute blueprint for new Doctor Who. But it's when you come across like a line like that, you just laugh and go, "Oh my God, the fates were properly involved in the construction of this show." It's such textual, a rich textual analysis, you know. You said this is the first VHS that you got. This was also, again, one of the very first Doctor Who's that I ever saw. I've said it a couple of times, but my friend Sean had, because of his brother buying a lot of the McCoy videos, McCoy was the Doctor I first encountered. I suppose a lot of people were slightly shocked when Doctor Who, when it comes back in 2005, is resolutely about normal everyday people in a normal everyday situation. I think I was less shocked, probably because I hadn't grown up with the series, but also because having seen Survival, and Survival being one of the most readily available stories for me to see, I think I was just like, I thought Doctor Who was always like this. You know, it was always set in flats. It was always set in, you know, houses and you know, and then the science fiction breaks into that. But it's always, you know, it's always something recognisable. So going back to the Powell estate, I was like, course it is. That's absolutely fine. You know.
So I guess the other big thing about Survival, aside from that kind of real world setting and that kind of foreshadowing for the new series, is it's like it's the return of the Master. It's like Sylvester McCoy's one and only Master story. And I think actually probably Anthony Inley's best performance is the Master.
Absolutely.
He's so malicious and he's so much out for himself in it. That there's something just really compelling about him in a way that I think beforehand he's just been a, for want of a, you know, to kind of do the old Anthony Inley cliche, but, you know, a bit panto villain. But here he's like, he's a proper threat, I think.
In episode 3, where Kara leaps at him and he stabs her with, what is it, like a tooth or something? And then as she falls over, he stands and he looks at Ace and laughs or grins and kind of sniggers or whatever, you know. It's so, it's chilling. Yeah. Like, it is scary and it is evil.
Yeah.
Evil, you know. He's great. But then also, you know, like, all the way through it. So he's obviously been polluted with the kind of the cheetah people, whatever. But I was thinking this, is this the first time that the Doctor and the Master actually struggle?
I think aside from that, the sword fighting and like King's Demons and Sea Devils and stuff, but
so like there's obviously like a gentlemanly sparring, but like where they actually one physically attacks the other, like there's no machinations.
I think it's the one and only time, really, isn't it? Because even when it comes to, well, I suppose I was thinking maybe Last of the Time Lords. Does he maybe like kick him when he's like an old man or something like that? But but actually properly. But that's very much a thing of power, you know, when it happens in the last time. This is, I think, the one and only time where the Doctor and the Master have, like, a proper feral scrap with each other.
Yeah, like, it's like a primal attack. Like, he spent all of his time, the Master, laying these weird plans and, like, these convoluted plots and traps. And then it just occurs to him with this kind of cheetah people disease inside of his mind. He goes, just attack the guy. Just jump on him.
Smash his head in with a bone.
And you can win. That way, you can win.
It is quite striking to, that that's kind of their final in the series, really. Yeah. You know, if it, even, you know, if it, like, obviously TV movie, you know, before that. But, like, say Doctor Who had never come back. I think there is something maybe, I guess it's quite Sherlock Holmes-esque, yeah. You know, to have the Doctor and the Master just have a physical fight, yes, in, yeah, the very last episode. Yeah. That it all just comes down to just that primal need to defeat the other one in kind of hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, yeah, it's...
But then the Doctor retains his character by not doing it, by not kind of taking that final blow.
I think it's a, yeah, I think it's a great Doctor and Master story. Over, yeah, everything else, it also, definitely, is. It's a great Doctor and Master story. And it's so far removed from Doctor Who even 4 years previously. Maybe even 2 years, mm-hmm, previously. They're a weird, yeah, kind of camp aesthetic. I've actually never subscribed properly to Anthony Ainley being a panto version of the Master. I think if people go back and, yeah, watch his stuff, he's far more subtle and evocative than a lot of people give him credit for. But this is certainly where he's at his most evil, genuinely a danger. Like, I love the scene where he's essentially a motorbike salesman to Mitch. He's in his weird campy safari thing. Or even,
yeah,
when he's,
it's really odd,
when he's in, like, the front room and he's looking in the mirror and it's just a shitty, chintzy mirror.
Yeah.
And he's got the bow tie and he's got, like... But there's no kind of, like, facial acrobatics of yeah, a camp performance. It's done deadly and straight. It's a great...
And also, I think the stuff that he does off-screen, you, yeah, know... killing Mitch's, well, dispatching Mitch's mum to the cheetah planet. That's,
yes,
what it does, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's what, you I know, would have thought. Made her go away. And it's like, well, they chased her out. Why wouldn't she have taken the kid? So the,
yeah,
thing,
exactly,
like,
yeah,
have
so...
actually just went, pew, like she's on the cheetah,
yeah,
planet now. So.
So, you know, just little things like that, you know, in front of a child.
Yeah.
That's really, that's horrible.
Yeah.
You know, he's dispatched a child's mother.
Yeah.
If you talk about kind of Doctor Who kind of tapping into kind of the primal fears of children and all that kind of thing, imagine, you know, watching that as like an 8-year-old kid and like, yeah, the Master will make your parents disappear.
Yeah.
That's like, yeah, it's like, yeah, God, this guy's really scary.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
far and above, I think, the perhaps the most chilling thing about him in this story is,
yeah,
is sort of how that kind of reflects to the kids watching.
I don't know, I think maybe the most chilling thing in this story is, I mean, it happens off screen so you can't be sure, but it's got to have been the Master that that helped Midge pick out his weird suit jacket choice.
Yeah, those leather sleeves.
Yeah, like, you know that way, like, so Mitch in his kind of like grubby Cheetah Planet survival costume is,
yeah,
is kind of, it's it looks fitting, it looks dangerous, and then,
yeah,
he walks in and, you know, like that the performance is maybe slightly tipping towards camp, but when he walks in in that jacket, you just want to burn. I don't understand how the kids at the self-defense thing didn't laugh him all the way out of the youth center when he walked through the door wearing,
yeah,
that kind of that weird half donkey jacket, that half suit jacket.
Yeah, he's got those kind of leather sleeves and that kind of raspberry colored shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an odd look.
Yeah, and you know the Master was like, no, wear this.
I remember watching that bit and thinking, you know, did Philip Seagal just, like, watch Survival,
yeah,
and base Eric Roberts' Master on that?
Yes, it's gotta be.
There's something about kind of that relationship between the Master and Midge, and the relationship between the Master and Chang Lee, but then also the kind of look of Midge in that outfit.
Yeah, he's walked through the door, and the only thing that he's not done is say, "I dress for the occasion."
Yeah. Well, it's the end. It's the end of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about what would have maybe happened if this had indeed been the end? Because I was thinking about it, and before the speech that obviously Andrew Cartmell quickly wrote,
yeah,
to kind of close the story, the series, I guess, you know, but also to leave it kind of open, because the guys at New Two interviewed Andrew Cartmell for a podcast recently, and in that he kind of said that, obviously kind of reiterated that point, that Doctor Who didn't actually get cancelled with Survival. The BBC kind of just stopped answering its phone calls.
Yeah.
It's kind of the analogy that he uses, you know. It's just like,
yeah,
he ghosted the Doctor Who production team. But actually, even before that speech, I think there is just something, you know, that there is this kind of reading that you can kind of take of, like, you know, the cheetah planet is destroyed. There's that line the Doctor has to Ace where it's like, it lives on inside you forever. Kind of like the show itself. There's something quite poetic, you know, and then they kind of go off to the TARDIS and have that kind of speech. You're like, yeah, you know, if the show ended there, fine. But I'm glad it didn't. And obviously we had the new Avengers, we had the audios, but there is just something, I think, in kind of, like, starting the series in 1963 on contemporary Earth and kind of travelling off, you know, around space and time, and then coming right back down in 1989, in the contemporary Earth of 1989, and kind of, I guess, sort of showing kind of how it kind of shows how the UK's kind of changed, in the space of sort of 26 years as well, in a way, I think.
I don't think I'd noticed that before until you said just now, but yeah, there is a very first episode is about contemporary normal people swept up into something away from their home, and the final story is about somebody who's experienced the same sort of thing. In this case, swept up by a time storm, but a doctor who has gotten somebody home finally, arrived back. They brought them back home. I don't think I noticed that before. And you know, there is, like, you are right. In the reading I've done, there was always that it was suggested that this might be either the last Doctor Who, or certainly Doctor Who would not be in production again for a while. But at every you know, like, everything that seems to have been done to give it a sense of closure seems to have been done on the hoof.
Yeah.
Whereas when you watch it and watch it fairly closely, it seems like actually much more planning, much more intent lay behind this to be. Maybe it's just a subconscious thing, but
yeah, you know,
if it had been Ghostlight or The Curse of Fenric as the series finale, this just seems so. Definitely designed, as it were, to have been. I don't know if we're reading into it, or I'm reading into it, because we know what comes after it. It's not the end. But I was reading a thing by Gary Gillett, I'm not too sure how to pronounce his name. And he was saying that, like, survival's one of these weird stories where it was the end, but you never really then, in the wilderness years, now, you just never really believe it was the end, despite there being so many red flags all over the production, you know.
Yeah.
So, and what I found surprising as well is it did seem to take a while before, like, finally it settled in, no more Doctor Who, because on the text commentary for Survival, this obviously went out in December, it wasn't until August of 1990 that the production office closed. So that from the end of production, so not even to the end of broadcast, but the end of production, there's probably like a full year where production would have had to have been moved forward. People would still be going into work and trying to work on the architecture for a 27th season, you know?
Yeah, they were. I mean, you know, they kind of had it all planned out, which is, you know, in later years been realised by Big Finish. But because I remember when I bought this, the reason I bought it was I wanted to see how it ended. You know, I wanted to see how Doctor Who ended, you know.
When you bought the VHS?
Yeah. Mm. And then being like, first of all, kind of just like really just gripped by the story and really enjoying it. Like, I think it's one of those Doctor Who stories that I think I've watched more than any other.
Mm, same.
Because I just love it. I absolutely love it. So that was the first thing. But then, yeah, it is that kind of thing. You kind of go, well, actually, if that is the end, fine. You know, because what else could you do with Doctor Who but just leave it open-ended? You know, it's not the sort of show that I think gets a clean, like, cut and dry, this is the end. You know? Because it's about these kind of, like, infinite possibilities. It's a, you know, because he can, well, I said he, she now can go anywhere. And I think that's why it's had such a long life, and that's why between, you know, Survival and Rose, we've, you know, had, what, four ranges of books, technically. You know, we've had The Missing Adventures, the New Adventures, The Missing Adventures, then the Eighth Doctor novels and the Past Doctor novels.
Yeah.
You know, Big Finish, because it's such a huge thing, Doctor Who.
Yeah, the only way you could ever do a final episode of Doctor Who is the Doctor's death, and that would be a story impossible to tell.
We'll come to that, I suppose, when we do the next series. The idea of the Doctor's death. Because, you know, all things die and everything comes to its end and all that kind of thing, but you don't really necessarily want to see it.
No, and there's no way, it's like,
you
could
never
realise
it in a way that would be meaningful, because everybody hates how TV shows end. Everybody hates it.
Yeah.
It's like Seinfeld, you know. Everybody hates the ending of Seinfeld. And you're like, well, what else, you know, like, how else could you end it?
Yeah. You know, it's not just that. I mean, like, a finale of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah.
Finale of Star Trek Voyager. As a Star Trek fan, those are bad ways. Now, with Next Generation, they didn't really need to end it because there was going to be a series of films.
Well, it doesn't end, though, does it? It just carries on. Like, it provides a story that kind of provides a kind of overview of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Of that series, yeah. You know, but then, that, you know, that's why they are mega careful with Deep Space Nine, that it is essentially a linked block of 10 episodes at the end of Series 7 to make sure that everybody gets... and you would argue, maybe a bit too clinical and methodical, giving everybody such an out and a change. But yeah, Seinfeld, as a Seinfeld fan as well. I mean, I found it absolutely fine. I don't know why people were getting so het up about it, but, you know, it was, for a show that was about no hugging and no learning, it was surprisingly, a surprisingly emotional thing for people.
Yeah.
And because they invested that emotion and didn't get given back to them, they got so cross at it, you know, so.
I know that we're not a Seinfeld podcast, but I watched the last episode of Seinfeld again fairly recently. And love, there's like loads of really great gags in it where like Larry David like sends up the kind of idea of like what you would do in like the last ever episode of a sitcom. Like there's that bit where they think the plane's going to crash and like it looks as if Elaine's going to like confess her love for Jerry, but it's just like, they just go, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. And then something, I can't remember what else happens, but there's a few little gags like that where it kind of seems as if, you know, there's going to be the sitcom ending that you would expect, but then it never kind of pays it. Any mind.
Or what was the Will and Grace ending where it's like it jumps forward like 20 years?
Yeah,
then
they're not friends anymore or something.
Yeah, but then this new series of Will and Grace, they've went, oh no, that episode doesn't exist. You know. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, you're right. We're a Doctor Who podcast, sort of thing. But yeah, I think this is a good ending, and it's also a great pilot. Because that's what it is. I mean, if there are two parents to the new series, it is survival and it is the TV movie.
Mm.
Like that is the prequels.
Yeah.
To modern Doctor Who.
It is funny, isn't it, how there is such a clear through line. Like we discovered with the first 5 decades poll, as we played another round of Gegsy's Where Does It Come Game. The having an unearthly child, survival, and Ghostlight all together in those kind of three positions. There's this kind of weird, I don't believe in that kind of bollocks at all, but there is this kind of odd kind of cosmic coincidence when it comes to Doctor Who.
Yeah, very pitch of doom, isn't it?
Yes. But, and you know, the very fact that the end of survival kind of by way of the TV movie leads into the opening of Rose is just another one of those kind of weird coincidences that I don't think was ever planned, you know. But yeah, it's just really odd.
But what do you think of the, I mean, obviously the monsters are the cheetah people. What do you think of the design elements of the sci-fi aspect of the story?
I think the planet, in terms of, you know, it's a quarry, as you know, that kind of cliche of Doctor Who. But I think it's realised quite well, that kind of, what do you call it? It's not chroma key, it's paint, is it? I can't remember, that kind of...
Paint box.
Yeah, that kind of, like, the sort of pinking up the sky and the kind of filters. And there's a kind of Western aesthetic to it, you know, like everybody's on horseback. And, you know, that scene where the Master... It's a bit Apocalypse Now, but it's also a bit, it's a bit the Searchers as well, that kind of, when the Doctor and Patterson enter the camp, you know, and the Master kind of throws the ball to the Cheetah people, and they're kind of, they all surround Patterson. I love those kind of little elements to it. So, I quite like those kind of sequences on the Cheetah planet.
Yeah. Well, bring it in. What is your favourite scene?
Oh, so many. So many. I quite like the youth club scene, actually. The first one.
Mm-hmm.
Where Patterson kind of chases the Doctor and Ace out of the youth club by being just, like, terrible to both of them. Like, giving Ace a hard time for, like, never phoning or writing or anything like that. Just, you know, stressing her parents out. And then the Doctor a kind of hard time about his weight. I think that's quite a good scene because it is that kind of thing. Again, it's a scene that you don't necessarily expect to find in the Doctor Who story. It's a setting you're familiar with in your day-to-day life, but not with that kind of Doctor Who element to it. I think that's great. And then the kind of final confrontation between the Doctor and the Master, I think, is really good as well.
Yeah, there's loads of things in episode 3.
Yeah, yeah.
I just love. I love Halen Pace's cameo. I love that shop scene. It's so foreboding and heightened and a little disconnected. Eerie, I think is eerie. I ultimately means nothing. What are those two characters doing other than being Hale and Pace doing cameos? But there's just something incredibly interesting about it, which is kind of great atmosphere building. Who's your favourite performance?
Anthony Ainley, I think. Because, you know, it's his last performance as the Master, and he is just absolutely terrific. Menacing, malicious, a proper threat in a way the Master hasn't been maybe ever, actually.
Yeah, you wouldn't have got Roger Delgado's Master just knifing somebody.
No, you wouldn't have. You definitely wouldn't have. You know, he's very hands-on in his dispatching of... So I think Anthony Ainley for me.
I think McCoy is the best Doctor he's ever been in this.
Yeah.
I think Sophie Aldred is brilliant in this. Anthony Ainley. Julian Holloway as Patterson is great. I'm going to give... This is our podcast. I'm going to give it to all four of them. I suppose with Classic Doctor, I wanted to do this like a billion recordings ago and talk about when we get to Classic Doctor Who. What is your favourite individual episode of the serial? Is that worth introducing as a subject?
Maybe, yeah. What is my favourite individual episode? I think 3 is... It's certainly the one where the most happens. You know what I mean? It's, you know... There's a motorbike game of chicken. There's, you know... They sort of go to the flat. There's the final battle between the Doctor and the Master. There's, like, loads going on. And it never feels like they're kind of packing everything in into the last episode. It feels like that's kind of events reaching their kind of natural conclusion.
I'm with you on it being episode 3. There are just so many directorial and performance choices which just scream like new and vibrancy to any Doctor Who that's gone before. Like that slow motion run of Kara and Ace. The fact that it's a new element to the Doctor and Master's relationship, as we talked about, that they're just scrapping. Yeah. Like, it just seems like a lot of fret. The very last episode of the 26-year run of Doctor Who, that actually, when you watch that single episode, it just feels new and fresh and exciting and like, oh my God, season 27 when it comes back is going to be amazing and brave and like modern television. This is going to be... I think the final one, but I think episode 1 is great as well. I think they're great. I think they're really great at just eerie,
building that kind of eerie atmosphere, but also kind of building a mystery of kind of what's going on. And actually, I think one of my favourite things about episode 1 is that it's one of the few times that we see the Doctor properly bored. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like for the first sort of 5 minutes of the episodes, like the bit where they go up the heath or whatever it is, Yeah. And Ace is kind of looking at the sort of like notice board, and you just see the Doctor just like yawning. And she's like, "Are you bored?" And he's like, yeah. "Do you want to go back to the TARDIS?" Mm. It's just a lovely bit between the two of them. Yeah. It's really great.
Yeah,
it's just I love Survival, and the thing I loved about Survival most this time, I put it up on our Twitter account, is that I've watched it, like I say, more times than I think I've watched any Doctor Who. And this was the first time that I noticed that Derek is wearing a Let's Dance tour t-shirt, like a David Bowie Let's Dance tour shirt. And I was just like, oh, that's great. Like, yeah, he's a Bowie fan. And then it occurred to me, and I was like, this must have been a deliberate choice, because Let's Dance, the last track on that album, is Cat People, which is the song Bowie did for the Paul Schrader remake of the Jacques Tourneur film. So I was just like, that's what I'm like, just still finding all these little touches, like even now, you know, sort of almost 30 years after it.
Yeah.
After it went out. Amazing.
So I've enjoyed this. I've enjoyed these two episodes. These two stories. That is Survival. What have we got coming up next podcast, Mark?
Well, next time it is The Girl Who Waited, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're going to pair that up with Modern Undead.
That's what we're doing.
Because, you know, crazy time shenanigans, two versions of the same person.
Yeah.
Must never meet.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen Modern Undead in years and years. So this is going to be... And actually, since Initial Broadcast have I seen The Girl Who Waited. So this is...
I mean, I've seen Modern Undead a bit more recently, but certainly I don't think I've seen The Girl Who Waited since it went out. Really interested to watch it again.
So if you, dear peoples of the internet, if you want to make any... I mean, we'll do what we usually do. We put things up on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
Should we have an Instagram?
Sure.
Why not? Tell you what,
know how to use Instagram.
As well as telling us your thoughts about our next batch of stories, tell us on Facebook and Twitter whether you want to engage with us on yet another platform, dear listener. That's coming out in 2 weeks' time. Let me think. So we're going out on Saturday.
I think there'll be new Doctor Who. I think we'll be out. The next set one will be out the Saturday before the new series.
It's okay. 6th of October, the 7th, and then, we'll be having we'll pause our Matt Smith watch through and have a. That one episode, the next one will be out. We'll do a special, The Woman Who Fell to Earth.
Because I'll be in Edinburgh for The Woman Who Fell to Earth, so I think we'll maybe do. I'll bring my microphone with me.
Yeah,
and we'll do a podcast. So that'd be good. Leave us a review on iTunes as well, or wherever you get your podcasts, because that helps, I think. We're currently at 5 stars, so only leave us a review if you like us.
Yeah.
If you don't like us, keep it to yourself. I suppose, yes, on a positive note to end with. You know, we've talked about Survival, we've talked a little bit about Rose, we've talked about Night Terrors. They're all kind of set in a contemporary Earth of sorts. And when Doctor Who comes back on October the 7th, contemporary Sheffield.
Yeah.
Another brave new frontier for Doctor Who to conquer.
Yeah. Well, you say contemporary. I mean, it'll look like 1971. Edit that out. So, what am I talking about? As I've said many times, nobody listens this far. All right. Well, nice seeing you, Mark. Thanks very much, listeners.
Thanks, listeners. Here's either Kev McCulloch or David Bowie with Cat People. I'll decide when I do the edit. It's been so long, and I've been putting on fire with gasoline. It's been so long.